Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible C 31, and it's April 28th, Monday. And I think we're looking pretty good. Anybody have any questions? I don't see any. I want to go over some stuff. What about announcements from SI? Okay, so here's the regular schedule. Monday, Wednesday, 12:15 to 1:45, and business 3:19. Okay. So that's still the same. And I'm going to turn a couple of these lights down, like right here. All right, so last time we were talking about the heart, and we're going to move into blood vessels pretty quick today. But here is a very nice picture of the heart we see on the right-hand side. And what are the first three things that you should always find on a heart before you get started looking at the anatomy of a heart? What are the first three things? Matter of fact, what's the first thing you want to find? The apex, that's right, it's the pointy end, right? That's inferior, that's really easy to see, right? And so think of the heart as a triangle or a pyramid. So if a pyramid has an apex, what's on the other end? The base, and the heart has a base as well. So here's the base of the heart, here's the apex of the heart, nicely labeled on this diagram. And that, so that's two things. What's the very last thing, the third thing? And a matter of fact, you would probably want to say anterior longitudinal fissure, because when you say that, then you also know what side of the heart, the anterior side, right? So we got apex, base, anterior longitudinal sulcus. Remember that anterior longitudinal sulcus curves around the heart like a candy cane stripe, right? It just doesn't go straight down to the apex like all these other blood vessels. It wraps around the heart, so you can always tell what the anterior side is. All right, and all these hearts, unless noted otherwise, are going to be an illustration of somebody's heart as you're looking at my heart, right? So if we take my chest wall away, what side would be over here? The right side. Over here is the left side, just like that illustration. So here we got nice left ventricle, right ventricle, and then you're ready to go because you know how many chambers does the heart have?
Four,
right? There's two superior, we call those atria, two inferior that we call the ventricles. Ventricles are much stronger. They have much thicker walls than the atria. You're going to see that in lab. And how many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Yeah, you're just going to say four and four. There are two atrioventricular valves, right atrioventricular valve, left atrioventricular valve over here. And what do we call the right one? Tricuspid, and then here's the bicuspid or mitral valve. All right, now before I get away from this slide, I do see some great vessels coming off the base of the heart, like the vena cava, superior inferior vena cava, the aorta, the pulmonary trunk, which is the most anterior. So if you're going to like open up an animal's chest or my chest and find your way to the heart, what's the first great vessel that you're going to bump into? Yeah, the pulmonary trunk. And it's going to look like the aorta because it comes right out of a ventricle, but don't be fooled. It's going to be the pulmonary trunk. And how would you describe the, what is the location of the aorta compared to the pulmonary trunk? It's going to be posterior to it. Yeah, posterior, right? So you're going to see pulmonary, aorta, and then posterior to the aorta is going to be the vena cava, superior vena cava. So that's just a nice order for you to remember. And of course the pulmonary trunk then is going to bifurcate to a left pulmonary and a right pulmonary artery very quick, and the right pulmonary artery goes right underneath the arch of the aorta. So that gives you a little bit of a background. Okay, so let's see. Remember the layers of the heart, the epicardium, myocardium, endocardium, and how many sides does the heart have? Yeah, there's a left and a right. The left ventricle pumps blood through a particular circulation in your body, and what is that? Yeah, systemic circulation. So I'm going to go, that would look pretty good. Ah, here. It's kind of a simple figure to look at, but it has almost everything you have to know in this chapter on this illustration. So here's left ventricle, right, and it pumps blood through the systemic circulation. Systemic circulation comes back to the right atrium, and then the right ventricle pumps blood through what circulation? Yeah, the pulmonary circulation. You could say lungs, but we always say pulmonary circulation. All right, so two main circulations. You might be a little confused because we're going to look at the coronary circulation, but the coronary blood vessels bring blood to the heart, and the coronary circulation is just a little piece of the systemic circulation, right? So really you can break down your circulatory system into these two circuits, pulmonary and systemic. All right, and we traced a drop of blood through the heart and all these blood vessels last time, so make sure that you can do that. And probably in lab, if there's not a video of that in Blackboard, I'll do that in lab maybe on Wednesday. Okay, so you can just copy that. All right, so let's get to fibrous skeleton. The fibrous skeleton lies right at the base of the heart between the atria and the ventricles. So the atria are composed of muscle fibers, and the ventricles are composed of muscle fibers, but for sure there's just more muscle fibers in the ventricles. And there is a separation between the atria and the ventricles, and that's part of the fibrous skeleton. So let me see where I can find this fibrous skeleton at. Okay, fibrous skeleton. Here it is right here. All right, so here's the fibrous skeleton, and it sort of is colored red. And I suppose there are some muscles, but there's usually a lot of connective tissue. And here I see some connective tissue here, some connective tissue here, but there's really a cap of connective tissue that separates the atria from the ventricles. And that does a number of different things. That connective tissue anchors all four of these valves in position so that they don't wander around. And remember, when the heart contracts, it contracts really violently. It just goes boom, right, and beats up against your chest wall. So there's something that has to be really strong that holds all these valves in place, all right? And that is the fibrous skeleton. And here's the anterior. What's the first great vessel that you see anterior on the heart? Yeah, the pulmonary trunk. Right at the root of the pulmonary trunk, I see the pulmonary valve. And then what's behind the pulmonary trunk? The aorta, and I see the aortic valves. And then behind that are the two semilunar valves. Oh, here's one. I see three little cusps right here. Which one is this? Yeah, on what side of the heart is that? That's the right side, and then here, for sure, I see the bicuspid on the left side. All right, so the fibrous skeleton holds these valves, and also it prevents the valves from dilating. If the ring right here gets larger and larger and larger, then these cusps, when they get together, they're not going to touch each other. Right, and they have to touch each other to close. Otherwise, they would just flap back and forth, and blood would be leaking, and that would certainly kill the heart. All right, so keeps the valves the same opening, and the fibrous skeleton also acts as a point of insertion for these muscles, because remember, in order for a muscle to contract and pull on something, the one end has to be held stationary. Right, so you could consider that like the origin of the cardiac muscles. And these muscle fibers right here share a lot in common with nervous tissue. Can you remember what's nervous tissue specialized to do? Yeah, vagus is important for parasympathetic outflow. It sends parasympathetic information all over the body. But how does it do that? Does it take a long time for that signal to go from one part of your body to the other, or is it fast? Yeah, it's fast. It's very, very fast. Okay, so, and what about the distance? What about a nerve? What about distance? Can send information fast, but long distances as well. Okay, there's certain components in a nerve cell that you're going to learn about in physiology that allows it to do that. But does a nerve contract? It does not. Okay, so you might be wondering, well, gee whiz, what's the similarity with muscle? Because what does muscle do? Does it contract or not contract? It does contract, unlike nerve fibers, but muscle fibers, just like nerves, have special little things in their membrane, certain kinds of proteins that allow nerve impulses to be conducted over the whole cell. And that nerve impulse, basically on the surface of a muscle cell, is the signal for it to contract. And the muscle cells are kind of interesting because the skeletal muscle cells, we looked at this way back when. Okay, cardiac muscle cells I think this is a pretty good illustration right here. Could you tell that these are cardiac muscle cells? How would you know that this is a muscle cell? First by striations. All right, so remember, cardiac and skeletal muscle have striations. Now, which one is this? Ah, here is the end of one cell, and here is another one, so they're short. Right, so that's got to be cardiac muscle. And it's also branched. You see these branches right here? Okay, skeletal muscle does not have branches. So it's got to be cardiac because it's striated, the muscles are short, and they're branched. Okay, so here is the junction between two neighboring, at least left to right, cardiac muscle cells. And if this muscle cell here contracts and this one over here contracts, then they're going to pull apart, except the junction between them is very special. It glues these cells together physically so that they can pull on each other. But there's something else, right, besides these adherens junctions. There are little tunnels that we call gap junctions that go through the intercalated disc. So that if one myocardial cell is excited electrically, that electrical signal can hop from one cell to another through these gap junctions. That's an example of a electrical synapse. All right, and then that electrical signal will come over here and hop into the next cell. All right, so muscle cells do act like nerves in that they can carry electrical impulses over their whole extent, their whole membrane. The only difference is, or one of the differences, is that muscle cells contract and nerves do not contract. And most synapses in the nervous system are what kind, chemical or electrical? Yeah, chemical, because they use a neurotransmitter. But the synapses between muscle cells, we call that an electrical synapse. All right, so what does that mean? That just means because of all these electrical synapses right here, if we stimulate this muscle to contract, then the one next to it is going to contract, right? And then the one next to that, right? And the one next to that. But what else happens? It goes down a layer, the next layer contracts. Right, then it does what? Because of the branching, it goes down to the next layer, and next layer, and next layer. So not only does the whole heart contract from left to right, right, from superior to inferior, but from superficial to deep as well, through the whole muscle wall. And that would not happen with skeletal muscle because they're isolated, electrically isolated from each other. So the heart contracts as a unit, and that's exactly what has to happen. Right, we can't have one part of the heart pumping while another part is relaxed, because the part that's pumping will pump blood into the part of the heart that's relaxed and not your body. And then if the part that's relaxed contracts and the other part relaxes, then blood is going to just swish back and forth inside the heart and not get pumped through your body. So the heart does have to contract as a unit, and these gap junctions make sure that that happens in a normal heart. Okay, so that's good. Now, what about skeletal muscle? Would it be a good idea for skeletal muscle to have gap junctions? We see it's very efficient for causing stimulation of muscle to contract, but should skeletal muscle have gap junctions? Well, if that were true, if one skeletal muscle contracted, what would happen to all the skeletal muscles in your body? They would contract. So, I'd like a sip of coffee. So I would reach out for that cup of coffee, and what would happen? My whole body would contract. I would never have a cup of coffee, right? Okay. So there are chemical synapses that excite skeletal muscles, but there are electrical synapses that cause the whole heart to contract. All right. This is the point that I was trying to get to. But it is important. So remember that there are four chambers, two atria, two ventricles. Atria are on the top. And it's the job of the atria to pump a little bit of blood into the ventricles. All right, so that means that the atria have to contract a little bit before the ventricles. So the heart beats, atria first, then ventricles. Atria first, and then ventricles. But I just told you that the whole heart contracts at one time because of these gap junctions. All right, and that takes us back to that fibrous skeleton. The fibrous skeleton is not muscle tissue, right? It is connective tissue. And that connective tissue doesn't allow electrical signals to pass through it. All right, so this blocks the electrical signals that are in the atria, causing atrial contraction from entering the ventricles, and that allows the atria to contract before the ventricles. which is pretty important. Well, it's not really all that important, because the atria hardly contract at all. But it is important they contract sometime. Otherwise, blood is going to get stuck in an atrium. And guess what happens to blood if it's not flowing? It clots. It forms a clot, right? So if the atria aren't contracting and blood isn't leaving an atrium, then the blood is going to clot in that atrium, and then blood won't be able to flow through it. Or it's going to generate clots that will end up in your brain or heart, causing a heart attack or a... What happens if it goes in your brain? A brain attack. Ah, but we don't call it that. What do we call it? We call it a stroke, right? But a stroke is really a brain attack, like a heart attack, when a blood vessel gets blocked. Okay. All right, so that's the job of that fibrous skeleton of the heart. Okay, so it does all of that. It electrically isolates the atria from the ventricles. Okay, well, let's look at the special conduction system of the heart. This is a nice exam figure. Make sure you know how to label that, especially for lab as well. Okay, what about the conduction system of the heart? Because we said that the atria should contract first before the ventricles. So how does that happen? Oh, good. Okay, question.
So the five skeleton, they block the electrical signal from the atria to the ventricles.
Yes, they do.
But if like this, you know, we need the atrium to action first, and then the ventricle action, right?
Yes, yes. Atria first, then ventricles get excited, and then contract.
And if the fibers block it,
how are the atria coordinated with the ventricles in terms of contraction? How do the atria always contract first, followed by the ventricles, if that electrical signal can't get through the fibrous skeleton? That's a really good question, and we're going to look at that right now. Okay. If you consider skeletal muscle, remember, skeletal muscle only contracts when you voluntarily tell it to contract. Okay. Heart muscle, on the other hand, will contract all by itself according to its own rhythm. Right? And our sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system then can just adjust the rhythm, can speed it up or slow it down, but the heart is going to contract anyway, even without innervation. Like, we take my heart out of my chest, put it on the table right here, it's still going to contract, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? And then we could take my heart, put it back, I would be fine, okay, because the heart is going to be contracting, even without nervous tissue. And that's because the heart has a pacemaker. There's one particular area in the heart that has the fastest rate of contracting, and that's called the SA node, the sinoatrial node. And we see it on this illustration right here. Here's the SA node. Now tell me, what chamber is that in?
Atrium.
It's in an atrium. That's good. But I want to even know more, because I'm really interested. Right atrium. Exactly. Right. Just below, or just inferior to the superior vena cava, this part of the heart has the fastest rate of contraction. And it becomes the pacemaker. And as soon as it starts to contract, then what does it do? It sends signals out everywhere so that the rest of the heart gets excited and contracts. All right, so there's no isolation between the atria, and as a matter of fact, there's special really aligned muscle fibers that take this electrical signal over to the left atrium so that basically the right and left atrium contract at the same time. All right, but it can't get through the fibrous skeleton. But look at this yellow tissue right here. This yellow tissue is a muscle tissue, but it's not specialized to contract. It's specialized to carry nerve impulses or electrical impulses, right? So it's really a muscle. It's not a nerve, but it kind of acts like a nerve because what? All muscles sort of act like a nerve anyway in terms of nerve impulses. This is the junction between an atrium and the ventricle. This first little thing right here is what we call the AV node. Guess what AV stands for? Atrioventricular. It's right between the atrium and a ventricle, right? And that AV node slows the electrical signal down. It grabs that electrical signal, holds down to it for a split second, and then releases it to the rest of the conducting tissue in the ventricles. So here's a special little pathway, right? So we call this the atrioventricular bundle. And that's how the electrical signals get from the atria into the ventricles, only through this one little pathway right here. And then it gets into, oh, what's this wall between the ventricles called? Yeah, interventricular septum. And again, there's some specialized muscle tissues aligned in these nice linear patterns right here. We call these the bundle branches. And now that electrical signal is not delayed, it's not held onto, it speeds very rapidly all the way down to, what part of the heart is this? Yeah, the apex. So now that electrical signal has gotten from the atria into the ventricles, runs really fast down to the apex, right? And then that electrical signal is spread out all over the ventricles, in particular the apex first. And all these little bifurcations of these what we call nodal tissues, they're nodal muscle cells, they don't contract but they share that electrical information, right? Cause the apex to contract first, and then as it goes up the free wall back up to the base, and then these more basilar, fascicular sections of the ventricle contract. So there is a little rhyme and reason to what's going on here because of the conduction system within the heart. And, you know, that makes perfect sense. The atria should contract first to pump blood into the ventricles, right? So they get loaded with blood. And then as far as the ventricles go, you should probably know that the apex contracts first. And when it contracts, which way does it force blood? Superiorly or inferiorly? Yeah, it pumps blood up toward the great vessels, right? The pulmonary trunk and aorta, so that helps pump blood out of the heart. If the basal regions of the ventricle started to contract before the apex, which way would blood have a tendency to go? It would get squished down into the apex, right, instead of up out of the heart. So those are all the purposes of the conduction system. Just remember, these are not nerve fibers, but they really act like nerve fibers. They're just specialized muscle fibers that carry electrical impulses, but they don't contract. It's a funny kind of muscle in that sense. So what are the parts of the conduction system? Well, you got the SA node that controls the rhythm of the heart, right? Then you got the AV node, which gathers the signal from the atria, but then holds onto it for a little bit, then shares it with the ventricles by going through the atrioventricular bundle. So it gets through the fibrous skeleton, and then down the bundle branches, and then finally the bundle branches then excite these Purkinje fibers, which then excite the myocardium to contract. Okay, and it contracts pretty much like skeletal muscle because you saw those sarcomeres. Their calcium is very important for cardiac muscle contraction as well. And sometimes somebody gets a heart attack in this region right here, and then electrical signals can't move from an atrium into the ventricles. We call that a heart block. Maybe you've heard of a heart block. And if that's the case, then the atria are going to contract at one rhythm. And remember, we said all muscle tissue is rhythmic. And then the ventricles will develop their own pacemaker someplace within the ventricle. And then the ventricles will contract according to whatever the rate of that pacemaker is. But it's not going to be coordinated with the atria any longer. So the atria will contract at one rhythm, and the ventricles, can I do it? Will contract at another rhythm. And it's going to look funny. It's going to look funny on an ECG. Usually that doesn't cause any problems for people because these atria are so weak, they hardly pump any blood into the ventricles anyway. Right? As long as blood doesn't pool in the atria, then it's really no big deal that the two different kinds of chambers are contracting at different rates. Okay. So that's the conduction system. Who's got a question about the conduction system on the heart? Can you figure out those different pieces, remember them? Because what kind of figure is this right here? This is an exam figure. That's right. That's right. So it's important clinically because various pieces of this conduction system can misbehave, and then, of course, you have to come up with different kinds of treatments for that as well. Or if somebody has a heart attack in this region right here, okay, then maybe they need a pacemaker to take over the job of the natural pacemaker inside the heart. Question.
If we have, you know, like high blood pressure or high cholesterol, so which one?
Okay, high blood pressure and cholesterol. Okay.
So we will be locked on the number two, right? The impulse.
Where are you? Am I on the right side or go to the other side? Oh, here, number two. You know, if the, in neither case, okay, if there is high blood pressure over a long period of time, then the heart itself is going to slowly die. It's going to wear out because it's working way too hard. But that really doesn't, and eventually it's going to hurt the conduction system, maybe sooner in some people than others, but typically it's the whole myocardium that gets damaged, not just the conduction system. And if somebody has high cholesterol, right, then there are problems in blood vessels where cholesterol likes to build up, and it makes them fragile. Right? And it sort of doesn't mean too much to the heart, except when the heart beats, right, and pumps blood into a fragile blood vessel might rupture, might fracture. And then that's going to cause a massive clot someplace, or maybe a massive bleed somewhere. Okay, so a couple of different kinds of things. Also, when somebody has cholesterol, it can also form on these valve leaflets. It can form a big bump right here. So instead of nice having smooth valves that fit together, now you've got that big rock between them, and the valves don't close, and maybe they don't open the way they should. So cholesterol can affect the heart that way. Okay. And what else can affect valves? Well, sometimes with a viral infection, even somebody our age or your age, when they get a viral infection, the virus can attack these valves right here and damage them. And sometimes people don't recover from that viral infection. Okay. That can be really damaging to the heart. You said something about calcium. Calcium is necessary for heart contraction, just like skeletal muscle. And if somebody has high blood pressure, it means their heart is contracting too strongly. All right, so we can think of a way to reduce the strength of muscle contraction, especially with regard to calcium. We can give a patient something we call calcium channel blockers, something that disturbs the calcium inside their heart so it doesn't act normally and the heart becomes weaker, which you might think might be a bad thing. But if somebody has high blood pressure, that brings their blood pressure back down. Okay, so that's good in that sense. But none of us in here probably should be on a calcium channel blocker. Okay. Fibrillation. Well, we said that all of these muscle cells are connected to each other, right, electrically. And we just went over how the normal conduction system works, right? Starts in the SA node, then AV node, then into the ventricles, right, through the bundle fibers. But if for some reason some part of the heart, okay, becomes damaged, maybe a blood vessel gets blocked, maybe there is a pacemaker that develops in a ventricle, and the pacemaker in the atria is still working, and maybe another pacemaker in another part of the ventricle, right? And they could be all going at three different rhythms, right? When that happens, then this electrical wave of excitation doesn't follow the normal conduction system. So instead of both the atria contracting and then the apex and then the rest of the heart, one part of the heart might contract over here and then another time over here, and then that electrical signal does what? Because of those gap junctions, it just can wander around anywhere inside the heart. And so instead of the heart contracting as a unit, it is contracting, but it's what we call fibrillating. Okay, so the heart is just kind of doing this. It's just kind of quivering. And when it's quivering, guess what? It's not pumping blood. But what is it doing? It is still exercising. It's still using up a lot of ATP, right? And in order to make ATP, this heart needs oxygen in order to make ATP, mitochondria. But if it's not pumping any blood, it doesn't get any oxygen. So that is a particularly dangerous situation. Right, when the heart is contracting and it's not getting oxygen, that means that it's going to die eventually. Right, so that's one way that somebody can die very, very quickly with when the heart goes into fibrillation. As a matter of fact, when somebody's heart starts fibrillating, how many seconds of consciousness do they have? Okay, and the consciousness is due to your brain, not your heart. Right, but when the heart goes into fibrillation, no blood is going to your brain. You have 2 to 3 seconds worth of consciousness. Your heart is fibrillating, right? And if somebody doesn't get it back going to its normal rhythm, then at one point in time does your brain actually die because it's out of ATP? 2 to 3 minutes, that's right. So that's why it's important Okay, if somebody passes out, maybe you can't feel a heart rate, and you're CPR certified and trained, what should you do for somebody? Yeah, CPR. And what's one of the components of CPR? Is chest compressions. And so then you're pressurizing these ventricles right here. Remember, blood can't go back up into the atria, so when you press on somebody's chest, where does it go? Into these arteries right here, which then maybe brings enough blood to the brain to keep it alive. Probably not enough to wake a person up. Certainly not want to come to class or anything, right? But maybe enough to keep their brain from dying until they get to a hospital and they can cardiovert this person by shocking them, right? And if you cardiovert somebody, then what do? You electrically stimulate the whole heart, and then hopefully when that happens, then this SA node then will control the rest of the heart and these other pacemakers will go away. Okay, so that's why it's so important to do chest compressions. Yeah. A defibrillator. Yep, it shocks the heart. Okay, and it shocks the heart so the whole heart goes into contraction. And then we have our fingers crossed hoping that when the heart relaxes that this SA node takes over the job once again. But you might have to cardiovert somebody a couple times. Right? And those automatic electronic defibrillators can monitor that. You don't have to be educated to know that. All you got to do is make sure you get the paddle on the patient. And there's a computer in there that will diagnose what the condition is, and it can tell if it's fibrillation or not. If it's not fibrillating, then there's no reason to shock that person. Okay. Well, there can be fibrillation. This is sort of fun. There can be fibrillation in the atria. Then, so blood will have a tendency to stick around in these atria right here and form clots. So if that's the case, then we need to give patients anticoagulant so that their blood doesn't clot, like Coumarin or heparin, something like that. All right, but before you get that far, probably you would like to convert that fibrillation in the atria to a normal sinus rhythm controlled by the SA node. And remember, you do that with electrical shocks. That's probably the first thing that happens. But if somebody's atria are fibrillating but the ventricles are working just fine, they're not unconscious. Right? They're still awake. They just feel a little flutter in their chest. But maybe they go to the emergency room and say, oh, my heart, it feels like it's just fluttering. All right, so what do we have to do? First thing, cardiovert them with electrical shock. Yes, and that is gruesome because when you give an electrical shock to convert their heart, guess what? Patient is still awake. And probably have to do it not just once, but many times. I hope that never happens to you. So maybe you're in an emergency room sometime, somebody's in a little room, and guess what they're screaming? No, don't shock me again. Okay, but of course, that's what? Very important to do that. So hopefully that never happens to anybody. Well, because maybe they cardiovert the first time, but then the SA node loses its viability or whatever, doesn't capture the atria. And of course, we monitor these patients. We don't just kick them out of the hospital right away. Maybe in a half hour or an hour, then they start going into fibrillation again, and they just have to be shocked again. In some places they probably do that. If that was me, I would also request that. But anytime you have sedation or anesthesia, you also have some secondary effects on the electrical properties of everything in your body, including the heart. So that's a call that the physician has to make, right? Okay. So sometimes you're not helping the patient when they're doing that, especially if they're on a lot of medication already, right? Oh, that's the other thing about medicine. A lot of times when you see somebody in the hospital, there's not just one thing wrong, right? There's a lot of things wrong that can go wrong with somebody, and when you treat somebody for one thing, that can have adverse effects on another system in their body, right? So that's why you guys are being educated, to try to figure all that stuff out. Okay, that's what we call judgment, clinical judgment. Okay, innervation. Well, there are nerves that go to the heart. All right, that's a visceral organ. So is it a somatic nerve or an autonomic nerve that goes to the heart? Autonomic, right, because somatic goes to skeletal muscle. Your heart is controlled by the autonomic nervous system. We wouldn't have enough time during the day to figure out how to control our own heart if we had to voluntarily. So remember, two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. We got parasympathetic and sympathetic. And the parasympathetic can adjust the heart rate because it goes to the SA node. It can slow the heart rate down. And that's pretty much the only thing that the parasympathetic nervous system can do. It doesn't go to the ventricles. It only goes to the atria, right? So it slows the heart rate down and the conduction through the fibrous skeleton. Sympathetic fibers go to the sinoatrial node, and it speeds the heart rate up. But sympathetic fibers also go to the ventricles here. And guess what sympathetic nerves to the ventricles do for the muscles of the ventricles? It causes them to contract stronger. All right. So parasympathetic can only control the rate, but not force of contraction. Sympathetic can control the rate as well as the force of contraction. And those are two different things. If we're talking about heart rate, we call that a chronotropic effect. Remember, a chronograph is like a watch having to do with time. A chronotropic effect, right? Both parasympathetic and sympathetic. But the force of contraction is what we call an inotropic effect. So inotropy and chronotropy are two different things, and only the sympathetic nervous system can affect inotropy because it's the only part that goes to the ventricles. Okay, so that's it from the heart. What's your favorite parasympathetic nerve? And it just so happens it goes to the heart. The vagus. Yeah. What is that, a spinal nerve or a cranial nerve?
Cranial nerve.
Cranial nerve, yeah. Which number?
10.
Yeah, 10. All right, you got to it before I did. All right, any questions on the heart? How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Yeah. How many sides does the heart have?
Two.
Two. Because there are how many circulations?
Two.
Two. And you know their names, right? Systemic and pulmonary circulation. Nice. All right. So now we're going to go to another chapter, things that are connected up to the heart, all right, and that is the circulatory system. All right, so let me find some nice pictures. Circulatory system. Oh, that's pretty good. But I want to look at some figures. I want to make sure I open up the right edition of the textbook. Circulatory system. Wow, look at all that stuff you've covered already. Vascular system. Okay, only got a couple chapters left in the book. Okay, here's a cross-section of some blood vessels, and I see two different kinds of blood vessels on this slide. I see one that is really nice and circular, and this red ring here is really, really thick. Okay, and then here's one that's kind of floppy, and that red ring is not nearly as thick. All right, and that tells me one is an artery and one is a vein. So let's make sure that we know what the definition of an artery is. What's an artery? It's a vessel that takes blood away from the heart, and since the heart is pumping, it's a high-pressure vessel. All right. So in order to contain high pressure, arteries have to be really strong. The walls have to be strong, and in terms of connective tissue, but also in terms of the smooth muscle that's within the wall of an artery. Veins, on the other hand, the pressure has dissipated already, so it's very low pressure. The wall of a vein doesn't have to be very strong. The muscle layers don't have to be very thick. All right, so here is a vein. It's kind of floppy. And so the pressure in a vein is very low. The pressure in an artery is very high. So the structure, the wall structure of veins and arteries is quite different. So here is a really good exam figure that shows us the different components that make up a wall of a blood vessel. And here's the word slide that has all of that information, but I just want to talk about this thing for just a little bit. All right, so in terms of this artery, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 layers right here, and pretty much the same layers for a vein. It's missing one of these layers. It doesn't have, for instance, elastic tissue in a vein, but it does have some smooth muscle that I see. All right, well, you might think that's a lot of layers that you have to know something about, but has anybody ever taken a geology class? Anybody ever taken geology? Cool. What about layers there, like at the Grand Canyon? How many layers does the Grand Canyon have?
Three.
No, not more than three. I don't know. There could be 50 layers there, right? I mean, just layer. I mean, millions and millions and millions of years ago, they all have different layers. So here is a slide that has layers, but don't feel bad, because if you're taking geology, you're going to have to learn a lot more different layers. But what's important about layers in terms of biology, right, they perform a certain function, but when they get damaged, that produces disease, right? And one way to understand the disease of a blood vessel is to know what layers are being involved. So knowing the layers is really important, because that comes with diagnosis. And nowadays, some of the ways that we investigate blood vessels is very interesting. Maybe you've heard of an MRI unit, right? You can put your whole body into a magnet, and they can make a nice scan of your brain or your head someplace. All right, but they're also making really small probes that they can put into a blood vessel and get a high resolution of just the wall of a blood vessel to see what's going on there, right, to come up with a good diagnosis. So understanding this microscopic structure of anything, your skin or blood vessel, is really important, because that's how we diagnose disease. So let's look at some of these different layers. All right, so we're going to look at layers in the three basic kinds of blood vessels. One is an artery, which does what? Takes blood away from the heart. Second one over here is a vein. It brings blood back to the heart. Which one is high pressure?
Artery.
You're right, because it's coming from the heart. Low pressure is a vein. All right, and any kind of fluid, whether it's a liquid or a gas, will flow from high pressure to low pressure, right? So that's why blood flows from an artery into a vein, because arteries are high pressure, veins are low pressure. But to get into a vein, it's got to go through the third kind of blood vessel, and we see it here. That is a capillary. Now, what can you tell me about this capillary compared to both an artery and a vein? What about in how many are the layers? Ah, look at capillary. It's really thin. It's basically only one layer with a thin basement membrane around it. But we got a lot of different layers in veins and arteries, and that's why things can enter or leave the blood only through a capillary. Both veins and arteries are way too thick to allow for exchange. Okay? And so here you have a bunch of systemic arteries with blood in them. Okay? And so what is oxygen in a systemic artery? Is it high or low?
High.
Yeah, it's high, right? Because it's already gone to the lungs, it's high in oxygen. Right, and this is one of the reasons why they reformulated the CPR rules not too long ago. Well, maybe it's been long now. Time goes by so fast. But remember, they restructured CPR to where you do less breaths and more chest compressions. Why is that? Well, because all of the blood in some person's arterial system is already high in oxygen. Right, and all you have to do is get some of that blood to their brain. Right, so all that blood in all of their arteries is oxygenated, and that's why you do more chest compressions now than breathing. You still have to breathe a little bit, but not nearly so much. You want to do more chest compressions to get that nice oxygen-rich blood everywhere in your body. Because that oxygen is what, once it's in this artery right here? It's trapped. It can't get out until that blood gets to where? A capillary, right? So when somebody's heart isn't beating, there's a lot of oxygen left in all those arteries, systemic arteries. Okay, so let's look at some of these layers. On the outside, we have the tunica externa. Tunic just means a coat or a wrapping, right? And it's basically collagen fibers. And so that just gives the wall a lot of strength. Collagen, you know, in terms of fibers, is what, a weak one, a stretchy one, or a strong one?
Strong.
Yes, collagen is strong. Okay. And then the next layer here, the tunica media, has got some, it's got two main layers. It's got some smooth muscle, and this is pretty thick, and it's got some elastic fibers as well. So some arteries are pretty stretchy. As a matter of fact, arteries that are close to the heart really are stretchy. When the heart contracts, it's going to pump a bunch of blood into the aorta, and the aorta is actually going to expand. And as that blood flows through the aorta, guess what happens to the aorta? Then it just naturally squeezes back down to its normal size. And then when the heart pumps again, it kind of expands and goes back. Right? So that elasticity is a very important component of a blood vessel. As we get older, unfortunately, that elasticity goes away, and that can damage a blood vessel, right, if a lot of pressure is pumped into it all of a sudden. Right, then the inner layer, tunica intima, has some more elastic tissue. It's got an subendothelial layer which connects the endothelium, and an endothelium is just an epithelium that lines this particular tube, right? So an endothelium is an epithelium, but it's lining the inside of something. So that subendothelial layer connects that endothelium to this elastic tissue. That's its job. Okay, this endothelium, you can see, how would you characterize this endothelium? Should I zoom in? Can you see that well enough? How many layers do you see?
One.
I see one. So how would we like to characterize that? Is that in terms of an epithelium, how do we characterize an epithelium with one layer? Squamous is a shape. Ah, simple. Yeah, so here's a simple epithelium, but we also want to characterize it by shape. So when you said squamous, you're absolutely right. So the endothelium is a simple squamous epithelium, just a single layer of cells. And these cells should be really smooth and slippery, right, so that blood can flow through it. If it ever gets rough, maybe with those cholesterol deposits or calcium deposits, right, then that rough area can form clots as blood flows through it or past it. And that can go to the brain, right, or to the heart to cause a heart attack or a brain attack. Okay, so that's the importance of this endothelium. When somebody has high blood pressure, right, that overtaxes these elastic tissues in the subendothelium and the smooth muscle, the endothelium here might also be damaged, right, and that will cause more kinds of plaques and abnormalities in the wall of this blood vessel that can cause blood clots. And under certain circumstances, there can be factors released that cause this muscle to contract, to go into spasm. And when the smooth muscle contracts, then blood can't get through that particular blood vessel, which would be terrible if this is a blood vessel, for instance, in your heart. Right? So those are all things that can go wrong. All right, so that's an artery. Then blood flows into this network of really small blood vessels. This is what we call a capillary. And you see that a capillary only has one layer, the endothelial layer. But again, it's what? Smooth and slippery, just like the endothelium within this artery. And there are different kinds of capillaries. Some are more leaky than others. And we're going to look at different kinds of capillaries. But what is noteworthy about a capillary is that's the only kind of blood vessel that allows for exchange. This is where things can enter and leave the circulatory system. Whether it's the systemic circulation or pulmonary circulation really doesn't matter. And then these capillaries then join back together. When things join back together, we say anastomose. Right, so when things split apart, sometimes we call that bifurcation. When things join back together, we say anastomose. So all these capillaries anastomose to join this little vein, and then that empties into a big vein. And a little vein is called a venule. And a little artery over here is called an arteriole. But an arteriole is just a special case of an artery, and a venule is just a special case of a vein. So for sure know these three basic kinds. Okay, so those are some of the layers. Types of vessels, all right, let's look at some arteries first. So we got arteries, arterioles, precapillary sphincter. These are all good things. Okay, so an artery does what? takes blood away from the heart, right? It doesn't matter if it's high in oxygen, low in oxygen. Just remember, pulmonary and systemic are pretty much the opposite of each other. So in terms of the systemic circulation, how would you like to color an artery in the systemic circulation? Would you like red for high oxygen or blue for low oxygen, systemic circulation?
Red
in systemic circulation. What about pulmonary circulation? How would you like to color an artery in the pulmonary circulation? Red or blue? Blue, because it is low in oxygen. Okay. Now, there's going to be more than 10 students get that wrong on a practicum or a lecture exam. So make really close attention. Make sure you study that, right? So when you see a figure and you see a blue or red vessel, you find out what circulation it belongs to before you tell me it's an artery or a vein. Okay? Pay really close attention. All right, so here it says, an artery may be oxygenated or deoxygenated. Oh, wait a second. Could that possibly be true? Did I type this wrong? How can an artery be some of them oxygenated and some deoxygenated? Of course, not both at the same time, right? But give me the name of an artery that's deoxygenated. Let's just say I don't believe it. What's the name of an artery that is low in oxygen? Like the pulmonary artery. That's why it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. Okay? Give me the name of an artery that is high in oxygen. Any systemic artery, like aorta, for instance. Yeah. Okay. Arteries have the highest pressure, right? They have elastic layers and muscle layers. And the arteries that are closest to the heart have a lot of elastic layers. And so we call these conducting arteries. So they just transmit blood very rapidly to smaller blood vessels, smaller arteries. Smaller arteries are more muscular, which means that they can constrict and dilate. Right? So vasodilation means that the artery gets bigger. Vasoconstriction means the artery gets smaller. And when that happens, then blood can go to different parts of your body. So when a vessel vasoconstricts, there's a lot less blood flow. When a blood vessel vasodilates, that tremendously increases blood flow through that vessel. All right? So small changes in diameter cause large changes in blood flow. It's due to a fourth power rule of flow through a tube. Okay, what does fourth power rule mean? It's when you have a variable and multiply by itself, that would be a second power. Multiply by itself and then by itself again, that would be the third power. Fourth power means you have a variable, multiply by itself again, and then multiply by itself once again. All right, so let's compare. Okay, a radius of a blood vessel with blood flow through it. We said it's the fourth power rule. Well, let's just say the radius is 1. And we're going to measure the blood flow, and it's going to be 1. I won't even tell you the units. But now let's increase the radius by a factor of 2. All right, so the diameter gets bigger by a factor of 2. What happens to blood flow? Does it go up just by a factor of 2? No, it goes by 2 times 2, which is 4. And then times 2, which is 8. And then times 2 once again, which is 16. So small changes in the radius of a blood vessel cause huge changes in blood flow. So if we were to increase the radius a factor of 5 in a blood vessel, guess what happens to the blood flow? 625 times more. And so this is how your body regulates blood flow through various parts, by controlling vasoconstriction or vasodilation. It's a very easy way to do that. Okay, arterioles. All right, and arterioles have a lot of smooth muscle. They can vasoconstrict and vasodilate a tremendous amount. So these arterioles really are responsible for controlling blood flow through a tissue. So let's look at the slide on the right, the nice graphic. Here I see an artery, and here I see a little artery. This is what we call an arteriole, right? And it can vasoconstrict or vasodilate. If it's vasodilated, then a lot of blood is going to enter over here. But here are the capillaries. This is where exchange takes place. At the base of every capillary network, there is a circular smooth muscle that we call a precapillary sphincter. You've looked at some skeletal circular muscles. Can you give me the name of a circular skeletal muscle?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. orbicularis, like around your eyes and around your mouth. But a circular smooth muscle, we don't normally call that orbicularis. Well, we never do call it orbicularis. We call it a sphincter, right? A circular smooth muscle is a sphincter. And just like the orbicularis oculi and oris, it can constrict or dilate. And this then regulates the blood flow through this particular capillary. When it constricts, blood flow is cut off. And when it dilates, a lot of blood goes through it. If all these precapillary sphincters are constricted, right, blood can still flow this through this arteriole, but where does it go? It goes directly right through this little arteriole into the vein, and it returns back to the heart. All right, so this is what we call a meta-arteriole. It's just a thoroughfare, right, and it bypasses those capillaries. All right, so it just goes right back through here. Well, you might be wondering, why is that? Why would blood just want to go right through this tissue? Well, maybe there's a skeletal muscle that is being maintained by this capillary, and when you're sleeping, that skeletal muscle doesn't contract. So it doesn't need a lot of oxygen, doesn't need nutrients, right? So these precapillary sphincters are going to constrict, and so blood is just going to flow right through here and get back to the circulation, right? But as soon as you wake up and start using those muscles, right, then those muscles are going to use up oxygen and produce CO2, and they might produce compounds like lactic acid. Those compounds will directly affect these smooth muscles, causing them to relax, which means they're going to dilate. So when a muscle starts to work, it produces compounds that cause dilation of these precapillary sphincters, and you're going to see and understand that that's really important, because when these sphincters dilate, then these muscles get nice fresh blood to bring them oxygen and nutrients and to wash away things like lactic acid and carbon dioxide. All right, so when these precapillary sphincters are controlled, right, by chemicals in their surroundings, we call that local control. Where is that on the slide? Local control for arterioles and even this precapillary sphincter. Right, local control. So there aren't nerves that go to these precapillary sphincters, right, sympathetic or parasympathetic nerves. They're just controlled by the chemicals that surround them. So that's pretty handy. Okay, capillaries, smallest blood vessel, single layer of squamous epithelium that allows for diffusion to take place. Specialized for exchange. Three kinds of capillaries. Here they are. Continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal. This is in the order of how leaky they are. So some capillaries should be really, really leaky and others not so much. So let's find an illustration of these different kinds of capillaries. Right here. All right, so when I look at this blood vessel, I see a nice red blood cell right here. I don't see any white blood cells. All this other stuff, what's all this other fluid inside this blood vessel called? Yeah, plasma, right? And then here is a red blood cell. And that's about as big as a capillary, maybe it's a little bit smaller. It's about the same size as a capillary, as a red blood cell. As a matter of fact, for this red blood cell to get through some capillaries, it actually has to squish down a little bit to get through. But that's okay, because what can you tell me about the endothelium? Is it rough and sticky? No, it should be smooth and slippery, so that red blood cell can kind of squish down and get through the capillary anyway. All right, so here is one cell. Here's another cell. And notice that there are spaces between the cells, right? And we call that an intercellular cleft, which means that plasma can leak out. Any kind of relatively small molecule can leak out. But what about a red blood cell? Too big, can't leak out. And then here is that basement membrane. This is what we call a continuous capillary. It allows for exchange because of these intercellular clefts, but these clefts are not very big. Okay, so this is the least leaky of all blood vessels. I'll take a look at this one. The intercellular clefts are maybe about the same size, a little bit bigger, but now look at the cells. They have pores in them. So even more fluid can leak out through these pores, and small molecules as well, like for instance glucose and things like that. So I see those intracellular clefts, but these pores are what we call fenestrations. And again, the fenestrations aren't big enough for this red blood cell to get through, but it allows more plasma to leak out of it. So there are certain kinds of capillaries where you need a lot of perfusion, for instance, like in the kidney, right? Because that plasma needs to be cleaned by the kidney. It leaks out, and then the kidney puts it back into the blood on the other end, right? So that's a fenestrated capillary. And then the most leaky, you could guess, right? The intercellular clefts are large, right? And the tight, there's hardly any tight junctions bringing these cells together, and the fenestrations are huge. Right, and there's even an incomplete basement membrane, so things can move in and out of the blood very rapidly. This kind of leaky capillary we find in the liver, for instance. We call that a sinusoidal capillary. And the job of the liver is to clean blood. So a lot of this plasma leaks out, gets cleaned up by the liver, and then gets put back into the circulatory system. All right. But what is one common thing that all of these capillaries share? Sinusoidal? Fenestrated, continuous. They all allow for what somebody said, exchange, right? Unlike a vein and an artery. Things are trapped in veins and arteries. All right, so those are capillaries. Venules are just anastomoses of capillaries bringing blood back to the heart. So remember, a vein brings blood back to the heart, and it could be oxygenated or deoxygenated. Give me the name. I thought veins always were deoxygenated. So give me the name of an oxygenated vein or a blood in a vein that's high in oxygen. Can you think of a vein that's high in oxygen? Pulmonary vein, part of the pulmonary circulation. Remember, opposite compared to systemic circulation. And the colors will be the same as well. Okay. Actually, I want to go back just a couple slides to... Oh, look at those blood, look at those red blood cells. See, just squishing right through a capillary. That's pretty cool the way they line up. Okay. All right, now there's another big difference between an artery and a vein. Okay, it has sort of the same kinds of layers. Veins don't have as much elastic tissue. But the vein looks a lot more like the heart to me than an artery. So take a look at this figure right here. And can you tell me why a vein looks a lot more like the heart than it does an artery blood vessel? Can you see what's happening there? Can you see some structure inside of a vein? Ah, they've got a valve. Nice. You see this valve right here. Part of the endothelium forms these flaps, right? And that's a valve. That's right. Arteries don't have valves. Veins have valves. Heart has valves. And in those people that had the lab today, what are the heart valves made out of? What are heart valves made out of? You've got the layers. You got epicardium on the top, you got the myocardium, the muscle, and then you got endocardium on the inside of a heart. What are valves made out of? They're made out of the endocardium, slippery and smooth material, right? And endocardium is really the same thing as what? Endothelium. So the endothelium of a vein makes these valves right here. All right, so remember, there's very low pressure in a vein. There's very little force that's pushing it back to the heart. It has trouble doing that. So, but anytime you contract a muscle, it's going to pressurize this part of the vein, and it's going to squirt blood down, and it's going to squirt blood up. But it can move up toward the heart because these valves will open. But what about the valve down over here? It's going to close. So blood is always going to move on its way back to the heart because these valves prevent the retrograde flow of blood. Okay, so that's one thing that helps return blood to the heart. Whenever you contract the skeletal muscle, right, it's pressurizing these veins, and blood can only squirt back to the heart because of these valves. Okay. Also, when you inspire, what is your chest acting like? You have one of these things at home. What's it acting like whenever you go... Plug it into the wall, turn the switch. What does, yeah, vacuum, right? So your lungs are, your chest is acting like a vacuum cleaner, right? And so when you have your mouth open and your nose is open and you turn your thoracic cage into a vacuum cleaner, guess what happens to air? It gets sucked into your lungs, right? But that's not the only fluid that gets sucked into your thoracic cavity. All the fluid that's in veins also gets sucked back up into your thoracic cavity. And what is one of your favorite organs inside your thoracic cavity? Your heart, right? So every time you inspire, that sucks blood back to your heart, that's the second kind of pumping mechanism that returns blood to the heart. You got the skeletal muscle pump and the respiratory pump. Return blood, which is low pressure in all these veins. Oh, I'm going to pass out because I've been hyperventilating. No, just kidding. All right. But remember that blood only goes in one direction if these valves are working properly. It doesn't work properly in all people because sometimes these veins get over-dilated and then these valve leaflets do what? They can't touch each other. They just flop back and forth. And sometimes we say that we see that in superficial veins. We call those varicose veins. Blood pools in those veins because the valves aren't working. It can happen in deep veins as well, and that causes big problems because whenever blood stands still, what happens to it? If it's not flowing back to the heart, stand still, then it can form clots, blood clots as well, right? We call that deep vein thrombosis. That's really, really dangerous. All right, so these valves have to be there, and you can see your valves, right? So you can pressurize your veins right there in these little knots all along the way. Those are actually you have to push down toward the extremity, and you can see those little valves in your arm. They're pretty easy to see. All right, we're almost done with the vascular system, but not quite. So next time we're going to start here, always highlighted, pulmonary circulation. We need to look over some names of blood vessels in particular. Okay, sign and sheet going around someplace.